Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about a big FinTech acquisition and the surprising asset that your financial advisor might give you the okay on. Please hit subscribe to keep up with these and the latest in FinTech news. All right. As Matthew McConaughey would say, let's get started. With me this week is Steve.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Great. I'd be doing a lot better if I had been a Plaid shareholder.
You might have been, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a really awesome story. Or a good story, I guess, for most players. And I think we'll get into this. Visa acquired Plaid for $5.3
billion. $5.3 billion, with a B.
With a B, which, by the way, is their, it's double what they were valued at in their private valuation as of, I think, 4 months ago or so.
Yeah, I saw that. Doubled their money in less than 6 months.
That sounds like a
very crypto-y kind of return.
It's a pretty great deal. Yeah. So the question is for our listeners, I guess, what does Plaid do?
Yeah, that's a good question. They're the behind the scenes player for almost all the big fintechs, right?
That's right. So basically, if you've ever transferred money, if you've ever opened an account with, say, Robinhood or Acorns or Venmo, you've used Plaid and you don't know it. So they connect fintech players and fintech devs with big or small financial institutions. So for example, if you want to fund your Venmo account and you have to give Venmo your credentials to, say, your Citibank account, you do that via the Plaid platform.
Yeah.
And they ultimately...
Not plain, but Plaid, yes.
And then they ultimately connect to your bank using your credentials, doing something called screen scraping in most cases, which is where they just look at the information on the screen and then they feed that over to Venmo and then boom, instead of waiting for that 32-cent deposit to clear 3 days later, you can just do it quasi-instantaneously via Plaid.
So Plaid is the codependent enabler of... I'm not going through 12 steps or anything.
This it's just what they do. No. Yeah, they sort of enable this massive fintech ecosystem with, again, Robinhood, Acorns, Venmo, PayPal, of course, and all the players.
So they got all this money because they achieved what all the tech companies want to achieve. They became a platform, huh?
That's right, yeah. And they've also become a really successful one at that. So the number that I've heard in the news is that 1 in 4 Americans with a U.S. bank account has used Plaid. And if you do the math here, let's see, carry the 3, carry the 4, that's about 80 million people last year who've used the Plaid service to fund or take money out of a fintech platform.
So I wonder if this is just all going to be called, it's not going to be called Visa Plaid.
It'll all be Visa. No. It's actually going to be Plaid, the third option, because they will run the unit as an independent unit, independent of Visa.
Why wouldn't they just rebrand it? Did they say they would keep that?
They're saying they're going to keep the name.
They always say that at the beginning.
Well, they may change it.
Go ahead, sign it. We're going to let you. Nothing's going to change. You know, that always happens.
Yeah. Here's a check with 7 commas. Why would Plaid do this? I think their reasons are fairly clear. One of them is that Plaid, as I mentioned, is used by 1 in 4 people in the U.S. with a bank account. But they're actually not that popular abroad, so outside the U.S. So I think by going to Visa, Plaid can now essentially have access to a global network and maybe sort of have Visa's connections. Visa, by the way, is the largest issuer of debit cards in the world. So Plaid can now use those connections with those banks to essentially become better integrated with those banks.
Yeah, I saw Visa is, they said over 200 countries. I didn't know there were 200. Well, this must include principalities.
It must include like San Marino, the Vatican, right?
200?
Yeah.
I thought there was 180 or something like
180.
That.
180. When I worked at the UN, it was about 170 something, but now it's up to 200. Yeah.
They probably count the space station as
the ISS in its own country.
Visa.
Yeah, sure.
So this is a great acquisition for Visa because, you know, they're taking a great asset that they can leverage up into a much higher value by expanding it worldwide.
Correct. Yeah, they also see
Plaid isn't that big outside of the U.S.
It's not. They acquired a company called Quovo about 2 years ago, and they're mostly in the U.K., but they're mostly in the U.S. really. So now they're looking to expand internationally, and also for Visa, they get the added benefit of, say, you know, they see that Plaid and this new way of moving money around maybe disrupt the core business for a Visa. So this could be a way for them to either insure against that disruption or just co-opt them. So basically, we're going to buy you out and keep you under our control. It's also worth noting here that Visa has been an investor in Plaid for the past, I believe, two rounds or so. So I'm sure there's the information as shareholders in the company that we don't, that really led them to believe that this is a good investment from a business and a strategic perspective as well.
I bet all around us, Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley, where all the VCs are, you could hear the champagne bottles popping.
I'm sure there's a lot of going on all over the place here.
There's a few more Aston Martins getting ordered.
Yeah.
They got their payout.
So many Teslas.
Yeah, it's a huge increase in value.
The other issue as well is that by acquiring Plaid, Visa now has access to a ton of customer data. So let's go again to the Venmo example. You give Venmo your Citibank credentials, you log in. Now Plaid can see all the information in your bank history. Visa can now see what's in your account. So Plaid has been using that data to help companies maybe underwrite loans, like say LendingClub. But now Visa can also see that, and they can, I'm sure, develop that information to develop other products. So they get amazing customer data. They get presumably okay technology, and they get access to a high growth fintech player.
You know, one thing about this that surprised me was that I was surprised at the announcement. You know, we do this podcast, and you think of the fintech world as a certain way, like Plaid will always be around.
Right.
And it was a great reminder to me that things are going to change all the time.
Yeah.
And Plaid will go away and be acquired, and there's going to be some new things. So I shouldn't have been, I'm going to fault myself for being, you know, so surprised at that. You know, you think of Plaid, we've talked about them so much, you think, you start to get in a way of thinking. So it's a great wake-up call for me that, yeah, right, Plaid's going to go away, then something else will happen.
Exactly.
And whatever player you might like, Venmo, PayPal, whatever, they're going to disappear, change, reform into new things.
The only constant is change, for sure.
Very wise words.
Very wise for his enemy, absolutely, yeah. One issue to talk about here as well is that there's sort of some confusion about what actually Plaid does to get that data. So I mentioned before screen scraping, which is where they basically see what's on your screen and report that back to the other party. But they also have an API, right? They can basically connect more securely between a bank and a fintech provider.
Yeah, I thought that's how it worked most of the time.
It's mostly APIs. A lot of the bigger banks do have APIs that they can expose, or they can expose their customers' data.
That's where you log into your bank through Plaid. Then it's using the API,
Electronic information. It depends on the bank. Actually, the method through which Plaid will connect your bank is unclear based on the customer flow on the.
Oh, so I wouldn't be able to tell.
You wouldn't know. But, sort of a big rule of thumb here is that if you're going to connect with a smaller bank, it's usually via screen scraping. If it's a larger bank, like the top 10 or so, that's usually via an API. And this is an issue, I think, for the Plaid business model, and it's kind of creaky in a way. So that if you think about, say, you're willingly giving your credentials to a third party, your banking credentials, that is extremely sensitive information, right? And I'm assuming that by giving somebody else your credentials, you may be violating your bank's terms of service. So if, say, somebody is able to, for some reason, hack into Plaid and get your unhashed username and password and then drain your account, you may be at fault here, which is really interesting.
But we haven't seen a lot of that in, at least publicly reported.
We haven't, because a lot of it is tokenized. So they don't give you, say, you know, John has $5,000 in his account. They give you sort of a hash, a long hash code, that can translate to that amount. So the real data isn't actually being transmitted back and forth, but it still seems like an issue from a security risk perspective that you are giving away essentially your credentials to a third party.
So Visa's got to get cracking.
We should also mention that most of the investors in Plaid have been fairly large financial institutions, so Goldman Sachs, Amex, Kleiner Perkins. So
it's nice to see the big guys get a break.
It's nice to see the big guys
a nice
make
return
out.
On their money.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Finally.
Yeah, it happened. We did it.
Okay.
Speaking of big guys, what's going on in the financial advisor world?
Yeah, well, there is a return of 90% on an asset last year that, you'd be surprised that it would be that high, actually.
And it's not gold, I'm going to guess here. Sneakers. Is it sneakers?
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, it depends on the sneaker.
Yeah.
And it could be a lot more than that, actually.
This, I'm sure there is.
It's a crazy thing. You know, I've seen some people, they have a job as like a sneaker broker kind of thing.
There's right? a sneaker stock experts. Exchange, yeah. There's a website that will tell you how much a sneaker is worth in the second market, in the secondary yeah. market, I guess, yeah.
Well, if you have confidence that that'll be around for your home purchase or retirement, then more power to you.
Yeah.
But another surprising one, Bitcoin went up 90% last year, which...
Really?
You know, I haven't been watching it that closely lately. And it's been so up and down. I'm surprised that it netted up so much. And it's continuing to go up into early 2020. And for that reason, as well as a big issue for financial advisors and for portfolio management, is having assets that are not correlated with each other. Because you can get a higher return for a lower risk when there's more diversification.
That's the ideal scenario, right?
Yeah, yeah. Diversification is kind of defined as a volatility
yeah.
of prices. Over what time frame and, you know, how much is good. That's a whole other question. That's the hard part, actually.
Yeah.
But financial advisors are starting to take a closer look at cryptocurrencies just for this reason, the correlation and the recent returns, the return of crypto a little bit as it creeps ever so slowly into the mainstream, I guess.
But
it's definitely not mainstream yet.
Isn't this a bit like driving and looking at what you've passed, not the road up ahead?
So that's true. But a lot of these financial advisors, according to this survey, are looking forward and seeing the further potential of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to further increase. And you would think this is like 2013, 2014, but you know, as Bitcoin and Ethereum and Ripple are out there longer, more financial advisors and their clients, the investors, are getting more comfortable with it, apparently. You know, they said that 6%, you know, so a small minority of these financial advisors were allocating any of their assets to crypto. And they expect that number to shoot up a bit based on the survey results.
So basically,
13% in 2020. Still a small amount.
It's still pretty small, yeah.
Yeah.
It's also unclear what percentage of their clients' assets they're putting into crypto, right?
No. This is definitely an alternative asset. I don't have to look at the article for that one.
and it's also only for specific, more not risk-averse clients, I assume.
Yeah, right. Well, some portion, depending on... you know, the person's situation would be an uncorrelated alternative, you know, riskier type thing, whether that's 2% or 10%, maybe for a younger client or
yeah.
you have a little bit more appetite.
It could be
a little bit more, yeah.
You can buy art, you can buy wine, and you can buy also crypto.
These are all very risky. I mean, one slip of the finger on that wine bottle,
yeah.
maybe, right? so all of these alternative kind of things are definitely not intended to be... a large part of your portfolio.
So does this signal the arrival of crypto as a main street asset class for most investors?
Well, yeah, it seems that that's just crawling forward. I mean, they think I'm surprised actually that even 6% of financial advisors.
That seems actually fairly high because they're not usually the most
days.
Risky, right? The most risky people.
Yeah, I'm sure they get asked about it, and but especially after the crash. That they would be looking at that. But if they had guided their clients in early 2019, they would have seen a very nice return.
I'm assuming that the gains of crypto were larger than the gains of the overall market last year. Because the market had
90%? Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
That's pretty high, yeah.
Yeah, well, the respondents expected that 64% of them, I should say, expect the price of Bitcoin to increase in the next 5 years. Which is higher than the previous year. And 34% of them think that Bitcoin will at least double by 2024.
Wow.
And maybe they're seeing that prices are so, you know, with this crypto winter, that prices are kind of at a low for a while. And when the applications start, you know, increase as well, there's still, you know, all that institutional support from the CME and from other exchanges. And that's continuing to increase. So
crypto winter will give way to maybe crypto summer vibes, baby.
Eventually, yeah, yeah. Fidelity Investment supports cryptocurrencies, and so these announcements keep coming out just much slower than they used to.
Awesome.
So, as a long-term investment, There's been some nice short-term gains, some low correlations to almost everything else. But maybe to each other, there is high correlation because we saw, and you know, it's a truism in finance that when there's a crisis, all correlations go to one.
Of course, yeah.
They all move down together.
Yeah.
Almost all.
Yeah.
And we certainly saw that with the crash in early 2018. I mean, they all went in the same direction. But against other asset classes, they were differentiated. I mean, they had a very different profile, and looks like they will continue to have a different profile than any other assets you might have in your portfolio.
Awesome.
All right, now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it.
I have a cool number, I think.
Do you?
I think it's pretty cool.
Okay.
My number is $34 million, and that's the contract for Spencer Dinwiddie, who is a player for the Brooklyn Nets. And what's so cool about this is actually he's actually going to tokenize his contract so that he will release a cryptocurrency tied to his contract, and it will issue dividends as well. So he's essentially looking at his overall earnings, and in order to front load his earnings, he'll say, hey, I'll give you a piece of my contract, and super fans can basically buy a piece of his contract and get returns on that. I think that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and the risk return profile is based on his career and his future earnings. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, and they also say that he's actually maybe he was a bargain for the Nets. I don't think the Nets are doing super well this year, but not as bad as the Knicks, of course. But still not as well as say the Lakers. But the idea is that this could potentially revolutionize the way in which you can have both fan engagement and also kind of an interesting way to bring crypto or tokens into an NBA contract.
Yeah, well, this is kind of a very typical thing for any asset. Just like you can securitize or turn into securities like an auto loan or a home loan when there's some steady payout, anything that has some cash flow going into the future. And, of course, there's commercials for this for lottery winners. They can get the upfront money through investors. And of course, they lose a big chunk of their money.
You know,
that's the return of the investor.
Yeah.
Based on their cash flows, they get all their money up front and sell away the cash flows. And you know, famously, I think one of the first artists, if not the first artist, to do this was David Bowie.
Oh, so I remember this. Yeah,
Bowie bonds.
Yeah.
So he wanted to get the money from his royalties from all his albums up front. I don't know what he was doing, buying a castle or something. I have no idea. But he wanted the money up front. So he worked with an investment banker. I forget which one, but they issued the securities. He got all his money up front, and if the record sales went up or down, that was all modeled out for the investors, and they could win or lose based on his future record sales.
Although there are rules. Yeah, you and I probably can't just invest.
Speak for yourself, Steve.
Well, yeah.
Oh, you don't have your accredited investor card yet?
I do not have it yet. It's in the mail. It's in the mail. But you do have to have some SEC-derived you have to clear some SEC rules, and I think you have to be more than an accredited investor. I think you have to be some sort of special individual investor, and you have to put up...
There's a lot of rules,
and the minimum buy-in is actually $150,000. So, not for your average, you know, Main Street investor guy, but...
But definitely for the sophisticated investor who can...
And for the wealthy investor.
Analyze their risks and take the loss if they need to, right?
Exactly, yeah. Take the L.
So, yeah. if he goes down for an injury...
I'm sure there are provisions for that. Good question. I don't know.
Maybe I would think they would require him to have, just like with a mortgage bond or other type of securitized asset, he probably has to, part of the price for him and or the issuer is they would have some kind of insurance.
What I also like about this is that if he gets selected to be part of the NBA All-Star Game, he gets to bring 8 of his investors with him. It's pretty awesome.
Is that part of the deal? Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. He gets to pick?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Pretty awesome. Yeah.
You're going to send him flowers and after you buy your
share. And $150,000, but yes.
Yeah, at least. Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Always something new in the world of finance.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, I took a bath on the Bowie bond, so maybe this will be a bit better.
So. Even after he died, I'm sure
that was long. He did that maybe 30 some years ago. So those bonds are done.
Oh, okay.
So you missed out on that one.
What a shame.
Yeah. So my final bite is $6 million. And that's how much was the ransom for Travelex to have to pay to get access, not to get access, but to prevent the release of private data that had been stolen from their servers.
So I had a question about this. How much incriminating, or say how much embarrassing data it would be in this?
Well, it depends on how good the criminal is, really.
Okay.
Because they're giving out things like date of birth and social security numbers, that sort of thing. And then you have to do the legwork of actually stealing the money.
But I feel like this happens so frequently.
Reselling it on the dark web.
I'm sure that I have been pwned. There's a site called Have You Been Pwned? I have been pwned. And I'm sure that this would be sort of another drop in the bucket of data breaches. So I don't see this really as a big threat for Travelex.
Just another data breach. We're so jaded
jaded. Yeah, I mean, it happens with Yahoo, with LinkedIn. Like, everybody's doing this.
Yeah.
Everyone's getting breached.
Well, apparently not enough, because they didn't get paid as of this broadcast.
Well, they hadn't gotten paid.
They had not gotten paid, and Travelex kind of shut down and restarted a lot of their systems, so they were doing things by hand.
Oh my God.
The criminals got away with five gigabytes of data that they downloaded over 6 months.
That's like four movies.
yeah. But, in text data, that's millions of customers of data. Right. Who knows what format that was in. It kind of reminds me of something I just read where, in general with security, is that in the old days, you would say, oh, I'm online. I hope none of these people can find me in real life. And now people say, oh, I just met someone in real life. I hope they can't find me online. So the world keeps changing. And as our jaded breach comments show, that's, our sensitivities change as well.
It's just the new normal.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I basically, as a rule, I have all my data on lockdown. I can't apply for a new credit line unless I approve it. So go at it.
Check you out. Yeah. So they priced it too high, basically. They try to get $6 million. Maybe if they just try to get $1 or $2 million.
Make it small.
Would have just been worth it to pay off.
Start small, then build up.
Yeah, right. Good negotiating skills there. Sounds like some experience with hacking ransomware.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah?
No comment.
All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with our latest episodes, and thanks for listening.
Bye for now.